This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 194 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Max, long time no see.
We're back.
This time last week, we were in Pittsburgh.
Well, yes, we were there for the Wings Over Pittsburgh Air Show. Us, some of the other Airplane Geeks podcasters, as well as the Plane Talking UK folks and Airline Pilot Guys show. So we had a great time, but we really weren't able to do an episode of the UAV Digest while involved in that. Took a week off, so we're back.
We wanted to do a show, but it just sort of got out of hand and packing. And when you're taking a podcast on the road, you got to do a lot more packing than just packing clothes. You got to pack plugs and wires and computers and laptops. And so, but we had a really good week. I recommend going out to the Airline Pilot Guy YouTube channel and watch the live episode. You can see Max and I sitting there doing our other show with everybody else. So that was very cool. But because we're lazy and we got away for the last week, we decided the best thing we could do is have a guest, and a really good guest.
We have joining us Matt Sloan. He's the CEO and co-founder of Skyfire Consulting. Now, they're a drone consulting company focused on public safety, things like firefighting, law enforcement, other first responders, and the like. Skyfire was started by four public safety professionals and a commercial pilot. The company delivers professional level training as well as FAA consulting, equipment sales, and consultation. In other words, they're a one-stop shop for departments starting a drone program. As for Matt, he's an FAA certified manned aircraft pilot, also an accomplished drone pilot. He serves on the National Fire Protection Association's Committee on UAVs, which is working to establish the first real UAV guidelines for the fire service. You can find Skyfire at their website, skyfireconsulting.com. Matt, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we've got a lot of interesting things we can talk about. We have touched on drone use in the public safety sector a little bit, but we're really pleased to have you here and can talk to that topic in much greater detail. Maybe we can start with fire service applications. We've seen, you know, several reports in the press, I guess particularly in California, at least out west, of firefighting efforts being hampered by drone operators looking to capture some video. But as far as firefighters using drones in their work, where do we stand right now? Is this happening to any great extent?
It is, and it's growing considerably. So, you know, we started this company just over 3 years ago, and, you know, it was very grassroots. We went to our first firefighter trade show, and, you know, the question always was, so why do I need a drone? Like, this is a toy. I know, like, my friend got one for Christmas, but what do I do with this thing? And it's quickly progressed in about 2.5 years to, I have to have this. It's going to be the greatest thing since the fire hose. So it's really been a great evolution. We've literally seen it happen in front of our eyes. Just 3 weeks ago, we're at the Fire Department Instructors Conference in Indianapolis, and our booth was packed the entire time. So yeah, it's definitely taking hold. You know, the technology is finally catching up. When we first started the company, people were using, you know, GoPros strapped to things, duct taped, and, you know, now we've got some really solid products that work really well in tough environments. Thermal imagery is a big deal. So, yeah, we're seeing the pickup happening very, very quickly now, and it's really exciting to be at the forefront of it.
So I'm imagining that firefighters would use these drones to locate where the fire is in the building or in a structure. Is that kind of the primary use for these?
That's where we started. So, you know, the old adage is, you know, the first thing when you do when you get to a fire scene is you want to walk around the building. So you do a 360 survey, they call it. That's not always possible. So if you've got a really big building or there's brush behind it or there's power lines or railroad tracks. So a lot of times, you know, people were spending a lot of time trying to get a view back there. And by the time they figured out what was going on, it was already, you know, 10, 15 minutes into the fire. Now you can put a drone up and see exactly what's going on within 30 seconds. So that was where it started. Then everybody started to realize, wow, I can put a thermal camera on this thing. You know, search and rescue became a real possibility. So, you know, instead of 100 guys searching through a field, you know, one little square at a time, you can put a thermal camera on a drone and see a person very quickly. Hazmat, hazardous materials response. You know, you've seen those guys in the spacesuits. You know, if a train derails or a truck overturns on the highway, those suits are oftentimes way more expensive than a drone, and they can take almost a half an hour to get into. So if you think about, you know, a cheap Phantom or something like that going downrange, getting up close and personal with the little placard on the side of the train, they can know what's coming out of it before they even get out of their truck. So there's some real, real, you know, value proposition in there for those guys. And by the way, they're not putting their lives in danger at the same time.
Sure.
And searching for hotspots post-fire, right? I guess you could throw a DJI up and have a thermal camera and you could pick out the hotspots so that the fire doesn't reignite.
Yeah, so I'll never forget, I actually went out on a brush fire with some firefighters that we work with, and they were telling me that later that day they had to go back out two more times because hotspots that they couldn't see re-caught and started the fire all over again. So they're saving time, they're saving money, they're saving effort, and they're able to see this stuff very quickly. Real simple stuff, too. Like, we actually helped a local school out. They had a ruptured water pipe about 3 feet underground, and it would have taken them, you know, the entire week to figure out where it was coming from. We put a drone in the air with a thermal camera, and they found it in under 5 minutes.
Wow.
Because of the heat signature from the pipe under 3 feet of concrete. So, you know, even that even impressed us. So we're pretty excited about this stuff.
Yeah. Had no idea that the range of a thermal imaging camera could penetrate that. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, we're all familiar with the Part 107 regulations, but when we look at fire police organizations, are there other requirements that are applicable?
Yeah. So like you said, you guys, I know, and your audience are very familiar with 107. That's one option. The problem that we run into with Part 107 and public safety agencies are twofold. One, the responsibility for the flight follows the pilot and not the department. And so there are a lot of guys that are hesitant to say, look, I'm the PIC, the pilot in command. And, you know, if something happens, the FAA is going to be calling me. I'm cool with that. When you're operating for a fire department or a police department, they're very keen on moving that responsibility onto the department. So that's one issue that people are concerned about with 107. The other big one is airspace. And so, you know, if you have any controlled airspace at all under Part 107, you actually, you know, have to request a waiver to fly in controlled airspace. And sometimes, as we know, it can take 6 to 8 weeks to get approved. That doesn't work for a fire. So, you know, if you need something right away.
There's no anticipating the fire before it happens, huh? We haven't gotten that technology yet.
No, we're close, but you know, it's a few years away, so it's a very vanilla sky, but we'll see how we end up there. But yeah, I mean, you know, the other option is the certificate of authorization or the COA. I know a lot of your audience will be familiar with that term back from the old 333 exemption days. This is sort of a totally separate process. The public safety guys are already exempt from 333, so we don't have to worry about doing the exemption itself. There's two types of COAs. There's the blanket certificate of authorization, and that will cover you really under the same circumstances as Part 107. So daytime, line of sight, under 400 feet in uncontrolled airspace. They have now recently added the ability to do nighttime under a blanket COA, and that obviously is a huge benefit for fire and police. And then the second type of COA is the jurisdictional COA, and that covers your entire jurisdiction, whatever the airspace. So if you take, you know, one of the counties, the county I live in, DeKalb County, Georgia, we have Peachtree DeKalb Airport within that county, one of the busiest general aviation airports in the Southeast. So a huge chunk of their county is in Class D airspace. And so it wouldn't be appropriate for them to have to request permission every time. So they go ahead and get the certificate of authorization, all of that stuff is prearranged. So the FAA folks in DC talk to the air traffic control folks here in Atlanta. Everybody kind of gets on the same page, and there's rules. You know, if you're going to be 2 miles from the airport, you need to call this phone number and let us know what you're doing and how long you're going to be there. But the approval is done ahead of time. So that's why most departments are opting for the COA route rather than the Part 107.
Now, are they familiar with all these things at this point in time? In other words, are the public safety agencies aware of these different regulatory requirements because of what they're doing already, perhaps? Or is this a whole new thing for them to learn and understand when they start to think about using drones?
Yeah, no, this is a whole new area for them. You know, a lot of them are not familiar with aviation anything. And so I would say more than half of what we do is education. But, you know, there's some interesting sort of things that come along with it. And so, you know, they ask us all these questions. Well, okay, do I have to take a test? Do I have to go what certification class? And things change. As we all know, the ball moves with the FAA quite regularly. So that's why I like to come on shows like this one and kind of explain to people, like, look, this is the best information you're going to get. And I don't mean this as a slight against the FAA, but a lot of people that you talk to at the local, you know, at the regional offices or at the flight services offices don't really understand drones at all, and specifically the public safety application of them. And so there's a lot of bad information out there. So we're trying to clear that stuff up. The other thing that I wanted to point out is under 107, you actually have to go take the written test. Under the COA, the requirement is one of self-certification. So the FAA is a public safety agency, ultimately. The police departments, fire departments, also public safety. And so they sort of said, look, we understand that you have the public safety in mind. We're going to allow you to do whatever training you think is appropriate. In my opinion, that actually is an overcorrection. So it used to be they had to have pilot's licenses. Now they can just do whatever and say they've done training. There's a happy medium in there somewhere. So the training that my company offers, you know, we make sure as pilots that we teach them everything they need to know and that they're over-prepared.
Interesting. In terms of the hardware, when we talk about public safety agencies, that covers a lot of different kinds of organizations. Are there some particular drones that seem to span all of those, or is there more specialization based on the kind of agency or the type of mission? What are you seeing for hardware?
We're starting to get to an interesting place with hardware. It used to be that everybody was using the Inspire 1, pretty much hands down. As I'm sure you guys know, the Inspire has decent flight time. It's very good in high winds. It's good even in light rain. Then they added the ability to put a thermal camera on it. That was the be-all, end-all of drones. And it was really inexpensive. So if you look at a system like the one from Arion, the Sky Ranger, depending on the way you get it kitted out, it could be anywhere from $30,000 to $150,000 for that setup, whereas an Inspire was $2,000, and it did almost as much stuff. So, you know, it was for agencies who are, you know, budget limited, the Inspire was really the way to go. Now we've got some options. So, you know, I mean, the Matrice 100, the Matrice 210 that's coming out from DJI, dual camera ability, so you can do daylight and thermal on the same drone. You've got dual batteries, you've got water resistance. So that's really exciting for people. Interestingly, you start kitting that drone out, and it's about $35,000. Now there's some other options that you're sort of all in the same price bracket. So it's changing really as we speak. The 210 hasn't hit the market officially yet. Largely DJI is what I would say, mostly because of the cost and the availability of spare parts. Despite any issues that people may have with their customer service, it's gotten better. That's largely what we see people using.
Matt, this thought just crossed my mind, and I don't know if you can answer it or not, but flying in a fire environment, how well do these things hold up in thermals and the wind structures that you would get just from a fire? That's a whole different, how do you prevent these things from melting?
Yeah, well, I mean, they actually hold up surprisingly well. And this is one of the things, like, when we started, because we were the only ones doing this, we didn't really have anything to reference. So it was a little bit like, let's try it and see. I'm the photographer for my local fire department, and I was lucky enough to be able to fly on a live fire with them so I could test it out for myself, everything that we were saying. And it really performed remarkably. And I was using the Inspire 1 with the XT thermal camera on there. Just like you know, I've flown the Inspire in 55 mile an hour winds during a hurricane. It handled the wind.
We don't recommend you doing that.
No, yes, so you should not do that.
Do not do that one at home.
Yeah, no, we actually was with that one. We were actually doing some commercial work for the Weather Channel. So we got some cool footage there. But yes, there was nobody around. The whole place was evacuated and we were very safe about it. So but that said, it did really well. And at the fire, it did really well, too. The nice part, you know, with the particularly with the thermal camera, now with the Z3 camera and the Z30 camera, you don't really have to be all that close with the drone. So you can zoom in and be still, you know, 50, 100, 200 feet away and get what you need.
Are you flying yourself or are you flying yourself with a camera operator?
So we don't do that many fires ourselves, but when we do, it's myself and a camera operator, mostly because the camera operator can walk away with the incident commander and they're still able to see what's going on. Whereas I have to be in a certain place where I can actually have visual line of sight with the drone and make sure it's not, you know, diving into the fire or anything like that.
One thing that's always on the public's mind when it comes to drones is privacy issues surrounding that topic. Are there some special considerations that public service agencies need to keep in mind when it comes to privacy?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we recommend to our clients, particularly our law enforcement clients, it doesn't happen as much on the fire side, is tell the public what you're doing. You're not trying to make a secret of it. In a lot of cases, and this is dependent on your jurisdiction, you may or may not need a warrant to do anything sort of secretive anyway. So tell everybody that you're doing it and let them come out and see. Look, you know, you may think we're zooming in, you know, looking in your window, but really they're not all that great at doing that. If you wanted to do something like that, you'd actually be a lot more effective with a, you know, a handheld camera with a zoom lens on it. And a lot of these drones don't offer zoom cameras. Obviously there are a few exceptions now, but I think when you start to show people, look, here's what we can do. Here's why we want to use these things, not trying to spy on you, but look, your husband who may be a firefighter or your sister-in-law is a firefighter or whatever, you know, we're not going to have to put them in harm's way as much because we have this technology. That's a really big benefit. And people start to understand and realize, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Another big one, you know, another big benefit people don't really think about is people are doing accident scene recreation with the UAVs. They're using things like Pix4D and Drone Deploy. So if there's a big accident, the police can do their scan really quickly and then reopen the road. So it's actually helping with traffic too. So that, you know, something that we didn't really think about even when we started the business.
Hmm. You know, a lot of times I think people who own drones, when there's some kind of an event, an accident, a natural disaster, wildfires, whatever, would like to help out with their drones. Is that something that really is possible or should drone owners just stay away and let the pros deal with it?
Generally speaking, I think unless you really know what you're doing, I think it's probably a good idea to give them some space. That said, there are, you know, some very capable hobbyists, some very capable commercial operators out there who take this very seriously and are very safe about it. And in that case, I think absolutely, you know, please offer your services. The key there is that prior communication is necessary. So you don't just show up and put your drone up and start flying over a big fire scene. You need to call somebody ahead of time, talk to the incident commander. You know, we always say, just look for the lights and, you know, the flashing lights everywhere. You'll find the incident commander somewhere in there. So, you know, go over and say, look, you know, my name is Matt. I'm a commercial drone operator. I'm licensed. I'm insured. You know, let me be of service to you. I'm not going to charge you anything. So, you know, and typically they're responsive to that, or they say, look, I appreciate the help. Give me an hour and we may take you up on it. But I think the key is to have some communication beforehand. You mentioned at the beginning of the show the wildfire issue. And we hear this a lot. We have a lot of clients in California and a lot of them have asked, what do we do about rogue drones on a wildfire? And, you know, the answer is there isn't really a whole lot you can do, both because of the way technology is set up and some FCC requirements that, you know, you can't really take over the aircraft. But I always tell people that if you have a drone operator in your jurisdiction, get to know them, you know, and make them understand that, look, we're not trying to keep you from getting cool video, but you have to understand people's lives are in danger. And if you're flying, we can't be flying. And if you'd like to fly, let me know. And we'll find a time for you to do that when we're not flying a, you know, an air tanker in here to drop water on a fire. But it is a problem. And I think, you know, there's a lot more education that can be done around it. I think it's something that the FAA is concerned about. I think it's something that the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service is very aware of. And I think education is the key there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me that rather than show up on the scene with your drone and say, I want to help, like you say, develop the relationship in advance. So that, you know, that's already created. You're not trying to do it on the spot because that just doesn't sound like it's going to work out very well.
And there are some really successful examples of, you know, people in the community helping out fire departments. Some of your viewers may be familiar with Garrett Brill down in Joshua, Texas, just near Fort Worth. And Garrett, you know, is flying for the fire department pretty much three times a day now, and continues to do so without being paid as a volunteer, and is, you know, very knowledgeable about this stuff. But he went to the fire chief and said, I have a drone, I have a thermal camera, please let me help you. And, you know, they were very receptive to it. Now it's a really great working relationship. So it can work. You just have to talk about it beforehand. And, you know, if you're in an area where you wouldn't have had time to coordinate ahead of time, just make sure you go find the incident commander before you just assume that it's okay to fly.
And I imagine that if you do develop a relationship with an agency, that to work for them, I would think they would want you to be kind of reliable. I mean, if the situation is that, yeah, sometimes you're available, sometimes you're not, that maybe isn't going to be as successful as one where when they need a drone, they can kind of count on you. It's interesting that an agency might have to make a decision as to, you know, do we continue to rely on unpaid volunteers, or do we actually invest in our own system that, you know, we will always have on hand?
Yeah. So it is an interesting, you know, concern. There's a lot of grant money for public safety agencies to do this, and we are just now starting to scratch the surface of that. We actually have brought on a grant coordinator as a partner who, you know, our clients can work with to kind of identify where that money's coming from so that they can have their own equipment. But there is certainly nothing wrong with asking volunteers to come out and help you. Or even if you have your own system, asking them to assist you and fly your stuff. That, you know, that's definitely something that we see happen. You know, the one thing to point out here, too, is that just because, you know, drones give you a lot of information that you wouldn't otherwise have as a fire department or a police department, they do take resources away from actually fighting the fire. So very small departments, you know, they may only have 10 or 12 volunteers and only half of them show up to a fire. So you've got six guys fighting the fire. You can't pull one off to fly the drone because you need them inside with a hose. So, you know, there is a place here for volunteers. Absolutely. And understanding that somebody whose role it typically wouldn't be to be out at the fire might need to be out there flying the drone. We see a lot of battalion chiefs flying them and captains and public information officers. So it's very interesting to kind of watch how they actually resource it.
I was thinking being the geek and not being able to carry my own fire equipment, it might be a great way for someone like me to volunteer with the fire department and not necessarily be, you know, fully geared up and everything, but a way to help your local community.
I'm very proud of I have one of those awesome fire helmets, and I got the leather front that when they gave me the helmet, you know, because I was showing up at these things, it said firefighter on it. And I said, I'm not really comfortable with that. I don't want to represent myself as a firefighter because I'm not, I'm an EMT. So I got one made that said drone pilot. So I'm very proud of that. And it's nice. It's one of my most prized possessions.
I imagine.
So I totally agree. There is definitely a place for that there. There's also this is a little in the weeds, but there's an interesting regulatory, not loophole, but regulatory issue that has recently just been approved called the SGI, and that's the Special Governmental Interest Waiver. And essentially that allows a public safety agency to authorize a 107 flyer to come in on their emergency scene and fly on their behalf. Typically that's in a place where it's controlled airspace and they wouldn't otherwise be able to fly under 107. It requires a call to the FAA, but a police or fire department can call the FAA, you know, coordination center and say, hey, look, we got this guy, he's 107, but we really need him to fly, and it's for, you know, an emergency. And then, you know, the theory is that it gets approved, and then you go ahead and do that. So that's a pretty cool, interesting little sausage making tip here. But but this is what we do all day long, is, you know, look at CFRs and FAA regulations. So that's why we're here, is to be the experts. So.
Matt, do you recommend them doing maybe a post flight with the fire department? Do you recommend some sort of log or documentation that you flew this fire and this is, I think from an evidentiary thing, if there's an investigation, they're checking it out later. You would want that kind of documentation. Is that something you're looking into also?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's some really cool software on the horizon where, you know, you can do really good drone logging, where you can save video with geotagged information. You know, I think it is important to save that stuff, because you never know, even with a fire, it may become an arson investigation at some point and become a legal case. So, you know, documentation, as pilots, we all know is critically important. It's as important, with the drone world as it is in the manned world. And I also think too, you know, checklists and anything you can do to make your operation safer, you know, high visibility vests or clothing or landing pads, you know, cones, things like that. Any of that stuff that you can do, it may seem a little silly at the time, but you know, it's a safety precaution that you need to take. And certainly in a scene where everything's crazy and there's fire and police and whoever else, it's important to make sure people actually know what you're doing and where you're doing it.
Matt, we should talk about training a little bit more. If a fire department or a police department or some other public agency is thinking about utilizing drones, what should they look for when it comes to training or the kinds of expertise that you offer?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's this is the thing that I focus on the most, that I sort of harp on the most when I talk at conferences and things like that, is, again, the rules say that you only have to self-certify. So that means that, you know, if you or I worked at a fire department and we've been flying drones for years, we can just say, all right, cool, I'm good. I'm self-certifying. I know how to fly a drone. That really isn't good enough. And so I think it's important for departments to have some training that is designed in a way that makes it professional, partially because of the issue we just talked about. So if you end up in court, if the FAA comes to talk to you, or if, you know, you're in a homicide investigation and they're questioning, well, what kind of training did you really have to fly that drone? Just saying, well, I knew how to fly a drone, that's not going to be good enough. And so as manned aviation pilots, Ben Kroll, who's my co-founder, is a certified flight instructor and has been for many years. He helped us design a course that is sort of unimpeachable from a flight instructor standpoint. So, you know, we cover everything that's in Part 107. Absolutely. One of the things 107 doesn't cover is operating near airports, because you really can't. So we also talk about operating near airports. So we talk about, you know, understanding traffic patterns and what is a downwind leg and, you know, what is traffic pattern altitude? Because if I'm, you know, within a mile of an airport and there's a plane that's going to, you know, be entering the pattern, I need to know where they're headed and what they're planning on doing. How to talk to an airport on the radio. Aeronautical decision making and crew resource management are two things that, you know, we bring over from the manned aviation world. Just understanding how to make good decisions, I think, is a lot of the battle. And then the second day, that's all on the first day. It's a long day. The second day, we take everybody out in the field and we start with basics. So how do I fly this thing? How do I care for it? How do I turn it on? How do I take care of the batteries? And then we start to get into more, intricate things like autonomous flight and, you know, some of the special modes that a lot of these drones come with, 3D mapping, keeping a sterile cockpit is a big one. So, you know, these guys are getting peppered with questions while they're trying to, you know, watch the drone. And so we simulate that, simulating, you know, we've lost line of sight with the drone. It's now behind a tree or behind the fire. What do I do now? And so we try to put them in as many real world situations as possible. We now have probably over 50 departments that we've worked with, and they're starting to come back and say, okay, cool, we've got the 101 stuff, now let's take it to the next level. So we're actually doing a public safety UAV symposium in Colorado in June, where we'll be lighting things on fire and, you know, doing simulated bomb detection and search and rescue and hazmat scenarios and things like that.
Oh boy, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, you guys are more than welcome to come join us.
That's the conference in Fort Collins, Colorado, correct? June 21st through 23rd?
That's correct.
The courses that you provide, Do you offer them at a variety of different locations? I think that's kind of the flavor I got from looking at the website.
Yeah, we do. We actually will typically do it on site at the agency that's hired us. And so,
okay, you go right to them.
We go right to them. Yep. So we'll send a trainer out. You know, it's typically at least six guys. Firefighters work, you know, they're A, B, and C shift. So it's typically two people per shift that get trained. And but we've had classes where it's, you know, over 20 people, and other departments nearby find out about it and start sending people. So yeah, we try to be, you know, all over the country at various times during the year, so that we can get people into our general enrollment classes, or we can, you know, specifically come out and do a class for you. We've got three coming up in the next month or so. So Ben and I are going to be spending a lot of time on airplanes.
Busy, yes. And of course, all of those are listed on the skyfireconsulting.com webpage. The conference in Colorado, I see that's skyfireconference.com, where folks can learn more about that. So fascinating conversation. We're kind of running out of time, but Matt Sloan, we really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us and our listeners. This is a really, this falls into the, you know, good use for drones category that we love to talk about. And we're just so happy to have had you on the show talking about the application of drones to public safety agencies. So once again, thank you.
Absolutely. Thrilled to join you guys. And as things evolve, we'll keep in touch.
All right, David, I think that about wraps up this episode, unless you've got something else you want to add.
Don't yell fire in a crowded movie theater.
Yeah, don't do that.
But if you do, make sure you have a drone nearby just in case.
That's right.
I also want to thank our guest, who was a bit accommodating to us, Max, to the guest coordinator who dropped the ball this week. But Matt, I really do appreciate it. And it was a really good show. So thank you.
Anytime. Thank you, guys.
All right. Well, with that, you can find us, as always, at theuavdigest.com. This is episode 194. So if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, just visit theuavdigest.com/194.
And of course, you can find us out on social media. On Twitter, it's at @UAVDigest. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/UAVDigest. We'd love for you to leave some feedback on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. Also, we'd love for you to join our Slack listener team. You can send us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com with your name and your email, and we'd love for you to join the conversation. It gets kind of geeky there, but everybody seems to have a good time and a lot of in-depth conversations about the technology and data and regulation. So we definitely would like you to join that. You can get some swag at our Cafe Press store or become a patron of the show at patreon.com. And I guess, Matt, do you guys have a social media presence? Are you on Twitter or Facebook?
We do, yeah. We are facebook.com/skyfireconsulting and twitter.com/skyfiredrones.
So I guess with that little note, I'm going to say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.